So, thanks for Daryl having this ready. These are Daryl's words, not mine, so don't get mad at me. I've changed a couple of things just for accuracy and also for better representation, so that's on me. If you want to know what those changes are, I'll tell you after. The title of this sermon is, Why Do We Reject Jesus? The gospel reading from Mark chapter 6 occurs just after the healing of a woman with a hemorrhage and the raising of Jairus' daughter from the dead. It is two different stories of faith, and that's where the similarity ends. Unlike the two miracles that we heard about in Mark chapter 5, which demonstrate faith in Jesus, the first, what we hear today, is about lack of faith. But first, let us consider what it means to go home. All of us in this room know the significant difference between going home and going to someone's house as a guest. I always find the expression that a host makes upon receiving visitors a bit odd. How many of you have heard, make yourself at home? Do they really mean that? I mean, think about it. I am so tempted when I hear that to start leaving dirty dishes in the sink and dropping my dirty clothes in a heap on their laundry basket. Make myself at home? Really? We all know when we are told this that there are restrictions. Restrictions we would not have at home. I can raid my fridge. Remember, this is Daryl. I can raid my fridge at home, but probably not at the Rapleys, three doors down. There are many reasons to go home, and there are plenty of reasons some of us would rather not. Being fully different from us, Jesus didn't have the same baggage as some of us do in relationship to our hometowns. But that doesn't mean the welcome wagon rolled out for the Son of Man. Nazareth was a small community, a population of about 200 to 500, and everybody knew Jesus and his family. The way they talk about Jesus among themselves reveals their opinion. He is Mary's son, not Joseph's. Jesus is the son of a girl who was pregnant before she was married. And even though Jesus has a crew of disciples with him now, he came from ordinary stock. The people in the synagogue list his brothers by name and even refer to his sisters. In their eyes, Jesus is a nobody because they know who he is and where he comes from. It is Jesus' pedigree that will carry the day in their minds, even though the people of the synagogue start off by being astounded as they listen to him teach. And even though they have heard about the miracles that Jesus has performed since he's been gone, and even though they wonder at it all, they can't accept that Jesus is a somebody, because they are convinced that they, his hometown neighbors, already know who he is. Their minds are made up. By the time Jesus returned to his hometown of Nazareth, the stories of his healings and miracles had spread far and wide. Even the people in his hometown had heard of his popularity. So you would expect that he would have been accepted by the hometown crowd and welcomed with open arms. Unfortunately, that was not the case. He was seen as the son of a carpenter or the son of Mary, and not as the son of God. On this occasion, however, the amazement immediately turned negative as the crowd vocalized a series of questions that led them to the issue of Jesus' own origins. And they, hometown folk, seemed to know all too well where Jesus came from. A prophet is without honor in his hometown. All of us know that as careful as we are to create a public persona that is positive, our families and hometown neighbors know the real us. If anyone had the right to question Jesus' origins, it should be those who knew him best. Their description of him as the carpenter, the son of Mary, is something we might immediately pass over as insignificant. But it was far more serious than a simple description. Referring to Jesus as they did deliberately ignored any mention of a father figure. They know a lot about his family and chose to use that information to dismiss his significance. This description of Jesus was a direct insult to his character, his honor, and in first century culture hinted at one who was conceived illegitimately. This type of history with a fatherless lineage would be scandalous to them. From the Greek word skandalizo, which is translated as took offense. Unlike Matthew and Luke, who sought to clean up the scandal, Mark did not alter the tradition of Jesus and include a father. Rather, the tension between Jesus and his family or hometown was an ongoing subplot of the story. Despite the hometown's assessment, Jesus provided an alternative self-designation. Prophets are not without honor, except in their hometown. By referring to himself as a prophet, he associated himself with a long line of counter-cultural figures within Israel. In the Gospel of Mark, others would also view him in this way. In an honor shame society, prophets would have received honor, but the traditional wisdom of the age was that this occurred generally in places in which prophets were less familiar. Indeed, as Bruce Molina and Richard Rohrbaugh stress about the cultural mores in antiquity, honor was a limited good. If someone gained, someone else lost. To be recognized as a prophet in one's own town meant that honor due to other persons and other families was diminished. Claims to more than one's appointed at birth share of honor thus threatened others and would eventually trigger attempts to cut the claimant down to size. That's a quote. These questions of legitimacy and honor were the issue at stake all through Jesus' life. Yet as we see, Jesus was surprised by the unbelief of the crowd. And not because he was expecting to be welcomed as a hometown hero. Not at all. The lack of faith we encounter in the Gospels always caused Jesus to be amazed because he is all-knowing, almighty, all-present, and all-loving. Why would someone not trust him? If you consider the population at the time of Jesus, you can understand why he was not accepted. For starters, most of the people were poorly educated, if they had any education at all. They could not read the precious scrolls in the synagogue. So the only way they could learn their religious heritage was to listen to the rabbis who were educated. Jesus did not have the formal training required for rabbis. So in the eyes of the people, he was just a local boy who was putting on airs. To make matters worse, the scribes in Jerusalem spread rumors about Jesus, rumors which had also reached Nazareth. For example, in Mark 3:23, Jesus was accused of working with the devil. In the society of Jesus' day, a son was expected to follow in his father's footsteps, but not go beyond them. If a boy's father was a carpenter, then the son was to be a carpenter as well, but nothing more. But first, let me correct a misperception. The word used for carpenter in this passage is a bit misleading. The Greek word means laborer, manual laborer. It covered a whole host of occupations involving physical labor, like carpentry, masonry, even road building. Joseph was a lowly laborer, and Jesus was expected to be like him. Jesus, in assuming authority and teaching as he did, was way beyond his occupational lineage. In the synagogue the morning he taught, confusion reigned. The people who knew Jesus the best, including his siblings, didn't know what to make of him. If he had swung a hammer or laid bricks, that made complete sense. When the people heard Jesus teach in the synagogue, they were on the verge of applauding him. But they didn't, because they saw him as just a carpenter. Mark's point here is that what the people failed to see was that Jesus was following in his father's footsteps, not Joseph's, but his heavenly father's. Jesus really upset them when he told them that it takes outsiders to see what the locals refuse to see. So why couldn't Jesus perform many miracles in Nazareth? It was because of a lack of faith. We know that unbelievers, like the people of Nazareth, often fail to tap into God's power. If they had put faith in Jesus' wisdom, they would have heard God's guidance and encouragement. If they had looked deeper into Jesus' cures, they would have seen God reaching out to rescue them. Instead, they missed out on the greatest miracles of all. Jesus took the rejection in stride and continued his ministry by sending out the 12 disciples. He sent them out with only the barest of essentials, one cloak and a staff. He wanted them to trust God to provide for their needs. They were to concentrate on their mission. Plus, Jewish custom at that time was to offer hospitality to travelers. Jesus wanted the disciples to stay at the first house that offered them a place to stay in each city or town they visited, rather than moving from house to house. Warnings about the trappings of affluence need to be heard again today, especially when we hear stories of millions of dollars flowing into Christian ministries, dollars that are used to finance the leaders' lifestyles instead of being used to do God's work in the world. God calls us to let go of some of the assumptions and rules we have about how we have always done things. The rules can be more of an obstacle than an aid in our spiritual journey. He calls us to leave behind our pride and ego. He strips these things from us so that we might travel light again and rely on God's power alone to guide us and trust his grace to support and sustain us. So why did Jesus send out the disciples in pairs? He had three main reasons. First, a partner provides strength, protection, and companionship. Second, a partner also provides credibility. Deuteronomy 15:19 required two or three witnesses to convict a person of a crime, because a single witness was likely to make a mistake. And for the same reason, one witness had less credibility than two. Perhaps that is why Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses seem to always come knocking on the door in twos. Finally, a pair holds people accountable. A person is less likely to succumb to temptation when accompanied by a partner. Jesus wanted the disciples to know that they would travel the open roads of Palestine penniless. Would they be expected to be welcomed with open arms, especially in their own hometowns? Obviously, it wasn't true for Jesus. He also wanted them to know that the gospel message was a hard one to preach and a hard one to hear. Not popular, not easy, and not automatically earning respect, especially at home. Those who refuse to show proper hospitality or those who refuse to listen to the disciples' message were to be treated as pagans. As such, the disciples were to do what the Jews did after they walked through Gentile lands, namely, shake the dust off their feet as they left. Not only did this warn the offenders, but it also freed the disciples to move to more fertile territory, just like Jesus did after the people of Nazareth rejected him. Jesus and the disciples always challenged the status quo, and we need more people like them today. We need people who will speak the truth and shake us out of our comfortable lives. We need people who will comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. That's my favorite part. I'm going to read it again. We need people who will comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. We need people who will cooperate with God's plan for their lives. In other words, we need people of faith. Just like the people of Nazareth did not really know Jesus, it is possible for us to not really know Jesus. We can understand him and what he can do for us, but we often play it safe and refuse to take risks. More importantly, we might not know him personally. God uses ordinary people to do extraordinary things in our world. Jesus was just an ordinary man in the eyes of the people of Nazareth, but he was God in human form and could do extraordinary things. Every Christian has a part to play in God's master plan. This story today represents one of the few failures in Jesus' ministry, but it also shows his human side. Like Jesus, we will all face failure at some point in our lives. Failure is hard because society has conditioned us for success, but it has not adequately prepared us for failure. I added this person. We look at people such as Taylor Swift or Sidney Crosby and see only success. The only time we really see failure is when it involves famous people like Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes, Amy Winehouse, Whitney Houston, or even evangelists such as Jimmy Swaggart or Jim Baker. Those who accept God's call to follow him will face rejection in its many forms, persecutions, insults, hostility, contempt, scorn. They are the common situation for those who accept the call. And just like Christ rejected the way of glory and found glory in obedience and death, we must also reject the way of the world and accept the way of the cross. Christianity is not a religion for those who want success or power in the traditional worldly sense. Jesus faced failure and he kept going. We can face failure and keep on going if we have the faith, courage, wisdom, and strength that come with both believing in Jesus and fellowship with fellow believers. When Jesus sent the 12 disciples out, he prepared them to handle failure. He constantly prepares us for failure through his word and our faith. If we want to do something for the gospel or for God, we must believe them and behave according to their teachings. We must have faith and let our actions match our faith. When we do, Christ will do deeds of power through us, and the world will be blessed by our having been here.